listening to Stand to Reason's hashtag STRask podcast with Amy Hall and Greg Kokel. And we have a doozy here today. Question.
All right.
All right. So these are two questions from Michael Mott. So I'll ask the first one and then I'll ask the follow-up one. Mm. And I think this is actually one of the more difficult topics to think about. Here's what he asks. Isaiah 56, 6 through 8, Ezekiel 44, 15, and Zechariah 14, 16 may indicate that animal sacrifices will take place in the temple during the millennial reign. What's your take?
Amy, that one's so easy, I'm going to let you answer it.
Very funny.
Well, actually, there's one verse that you have done and taken a look at. Let's. Mm-hmm. The question really here is whether there's indication in the text that these particular sacrifices take place in the temple during the millennial reign. Now, when I looked at these before we started the show, at least the ones I looked at didn't seem to me to indicate that that was the case. And let me read the Isaiah passage. That's 56, 6 through 8. And the kind of a break in the context is started at the beginning of the chapter, which is headed Rewards for Obedience to God. And I read all the stuff that's coming up to our verse, verse 6. There doesn't seem to be anything in there that pertains to the millennial kingdom. Verse 6 simply says, as for foreigners who join themselves to the Lord to minister to him and to love the name of the Lord, to be his servants, everyone who keeps from profaning the Sabbath and holds fast my covenant, even those I will bring to my holy mountain and make them joyful in my house of prayer, their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be acceptable on my altar, for my house will be called a house of prayer for all the peoples. Now, this is a verse that Jesus himself quotes. I'm not sure if he's citing this particular passage. Yeah, there it is. The cross-reference is in Mark, when he cleanses the temple. So I don't... Well, the next verse, I guess, says, the Lord God who gathers the dispersed of Israel declares, yet others I will gather to them, to those already gathered, maybe Gentiles. Now, he is speaking of Gentiles here, foreigners. And as far as I can tell from this passage, he's just simply saying foreigners who are faithful, who come in, attach themselves to Jews, get the same benefits as the Jews. And as to God, who being the one who gathers the dispersed of Israel, well, that gathering started in the Old Testament time, you know, the return to the land. So I don't see how this is necessarily placed in the millennial kingdom. It's just part of the old covenant practices, and God's saying that the faithful Jews are honored, first six verses, and then it says faithful foreigners are also equally honored before God by keeping the law. So I don't see the connection there with that. So let's go to Zechariah 14, right? Let's find that. Zechariah 14 and verse 16, just reading the verse in isolation. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will grow up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. Now, this may be, I'm looking at the heading of this broader section, God will be king over all the earth, verse 9, and that day the Lord will be the only one, in his name the only one. All the land will be changed into a plain. So this looks like it could be a millennial celebration, but notice what's being celebrated here is simply the Feast of Booths. And this is a feast in which the Jews were to construct, temporary shelters, and then that celebrates the time that God took care of them during the wanderings in the wilderness in the book of Numbers, Feast of Booths. Well, there's nothing wrong with celebrating the feasts that God had established in the future in the new covenant system in the kingdom or the time when people are on earth to celebrate those things, to keep up those customs. So I don't see any contradiction there. I've actually been to a celebration of booths at someone's home and a Jewish person's home, and they just have a lanai, they have a patio, and then they put some stalks up and they make a little thing that you kind of put a table under and, you know, celebrate booths. So or the Feast of Tabernacles, I think, is what it's also called. So I don't see that this entails sacrificing during the millennial kingdom. It just entails practicing something that's part of the customs of the Jews that is a commemoration of what God did, and it does not have any... It's not like the sacrificial system, which was meant to accomplish something different. So I don't see a difficulty there. The Ezekiel 44:15 passage is one that you've looked at before, so why don't you talk about
that?
Yeah,
so I actually have a post on that that whole section. It's I think it's a couple of chapters or a few chapters. The name of the post is Does Ezekiel's Vision of a Temple Contradict Christianity? And what I found when I looked through here, well, first of all, if you go to the post, you'll see a few different options, ways you can interpret this from the ESV Study Bible. But what I found when I was looking at this is that there's a clear break between chapter 39 and chapter 40, where chapter 39 is a prediction, but then after there's a break after that, and then God goes into instructions. So what I see are instructions rather than predictions, because here's how here you can hear right here. This is verse 9 through 11. Now let them put away their harlotry and the corpses of their harlotry and the corpses of their kings far from me, and I will dwell among them forever. As for you, son of man, describe the temple to the house of Israel, that they may be ashamed of their iniquities, and let them measure the plan. If they are ashamed of all that they have done, make known to them the design of the house, its structure, its exits, its entrances, all its designs, all its statutes, and all its laws, and write it in their sight so that they may observe its whole design and all its statutes and do them. So what we have here are instructions, and it's not a prediction of what will happen. It's a conditional statement that if they repent, then they should build this temple. So it's more like the plans in Exodus, in Leviticus, for the building of the tabernacle. It's instructions. It's the way they're supposed to build the temple. But the passage says, if they are ashamed, here is the design for the temple that they should build. Well, they never built it because they never repented at that time.
They were ashamed.
Yeah. So I think this is a completely different genre from a prophecy. It sounds to me like it's just instructions.
For that period of time.
Right.
And not projecting into the future.
Right.
Okay.
But there are other interpretations. So if you check out the blog post on our website at str.org, then you'll see a few other options from the ESV Study Bible.
Yeah, let me make an observation about this, though. I don't know what the other interpretations say, but I know I've run into this with atheists in the past where the matter of interpretation comes up. And they look at a passage that they think is contradictory, creates a problem, they cite it for me. And then I offer an alternative, a way of understanding it that resolves the apparent contradiction. And then they say, well, that's not my interpretation. I say, okay. Then the problem is with your own interpretation, because your interpretation creates a contradiction, mine does not. Now, the reason that's important is, first of all, it throws the ball back in their court where it belongs at that particular point. But it also says something more. It points out that if the charge against our view is a charge of contradiction, that charge means that these two passages cannot be reconciled. They are necessarily in conflict. All that we have to do to parry such a charge is to show that they can be reconciled in principle. There's a way to read it where it's not contradictory. Because this kind of charge is an aggressive charge, it's an aggressive defeater, all we have to do is show that it possibly has an answer, so it's not necessarily a contradiction, which that's the nature of their aggressive defeater. It's necessarily a contradiction. All we have to do is show that it's not necessarily a contradiction to be able to sidestep that aggressive defeater. And this is what a lot of them don't get. They think, well, if I read it this way, then that must be the right way, and that creates a contradiction for your view. And if you want to find a way out of it, well, that's just your interpretation. Well, if it may be my interpretation, but if my interpretation is a plausible one given the text, and it escapes the contradiction, the apparent contradiction, then there is no necessary contradiction, and the challenge fails.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little detail about how this rational maneuvering works when there's a charge of contradiction. All you have to do is show a plausible alternative that escapes the contradiction, and you've done your job.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to show that your alternative is actually the true one.
And I just want to add to this whole topic. I did talk to a Messianic Jew about this one time, and his thought was that maybe it was people celebrating Jesus's sacrifice by doing the sacrifices as a representative of him, which I don't think is impossible either, because the sacrifices were never actually cleansing anyone from sin. That's what
mm-hmm.
Hebrews said.
Mm-hmm.
They were always representing the sacrifice that would come in Christ.
Right.
So I don't think it's necessarily impossible that we will still do that as a way of reminding, mm-hmm. although he did institute the communion. So maybe,
yeah, as a new.
But I don't think it's impossible. I think that's another possible explanation.
True. I want to underscore something. I'm personally not that comfortable with that kind of rejoinder, and partly because what I said earlier, you have to demonstrate what's not just a possible but plausible interpretation. So I think we want to be careful of sounding like we are having an ad hoc kind of explanation that saves our view, but doesn't really seem to be plausible given the verse. And we'd have to accept that. We'd have to say that what Ezekiel is doing is he's anticipating the finished work of Christ, which is celebrated in this, which he's describing. And that seems not so plausible to me. So people have to make up their own mind on this.
Yeah.
But I'm just underscoring, if we want to parry this challenge, then our possibility has to actually seem plausible to be a legitimate parry. But go ahead.
Well, I was just going to move on to the second part of Michael's question.
That's good.
So he has a short follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you make of Paul offering sacrifices in Acts 21:26? A Messianic Jew suggests they were in memorial to Christ's sacrifice on the cross. So he's heard the same thing I have as about that.
Okay, well, now we're talking New Testament.
Right.
Okay, so that seems more plausible because now we have Christ visibly having been offered, and all of that theology is actively in play at this point. But in this particular situation, where does it start? Verse what?
So it's
21.
I think it starts at, the story starts at verse 17, but 21:26 talks about the sacrifice.
All right, so what's going on here is Paul ends up in Jerusalem. This is his last hurrah here in Jerusalem because he's about to be arrested and then carted off to Rome, and that's much of what happens in the remainder of the book of Acts. But while he's in Jerusalem, he's met by the brethren. They are glad to see him, but they're warning him. There are a lot of believing Jews in the city that are sensitive to what appears to be his claim that the law of Moses no longer applies to the Jews, okay? So what are we going to do? They're going to hear that you've come, and they're going to make a fuss. And, okay, here's what we suggest. We got four guys under a vow. Take them, purify them yourself, purify yourself along with them, and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, and all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. Now, this is problematic because, and then it says he took them and purified himself, went to the temple, and kind of carried out the days of purification. The sacrifice was offered for each of them. Now, that would be the sacrifice that is offered for this particular peculiar kind of vow and purification, not a kind of sacrifice that would replace what Jesus was doing. It certainly is plausible that these customs to pursue these certain types of vows and the provisions that were made in the law for them are things that Paul could have pursued, because it doesn't contradict the precise nature of the fulfillment of the law by Jesus, a la Hebrews and that kind of thing. I'm not sure how long these. Keep in mind, Acts is a transition book, so there's a lots of discussion that goes on that first century about how this stuff all plays out. And earlier in the book of Acts, you have the Jerusalem Council to discuss this thing. Like, what do we do with the Gentiles? Do they have to keep the law? Because we have Judaizers that are saying, if you want to believe in Jesus, you have to come into the Jewish commonwealth and keep the law. And we know from Jeremiah 31:31 that the new covenant Jesus instituted there, according to his own words, this is the new covenant in my blood, that was to replace the old covenant, which the Jews broke. So, you know, there's a transition of moving out of one and into another. And there are lots of details of the Hebrew law that are, in a certain sense, spiritually innocuous, in the sense that they don't contradict anything that Jesus did on the cross. They are part of the culture of the Jews. The Nazarite vow, for example, you know, could easily have been made and then kept, and the appropriate things done to solidify that vow. And it being an expression of honoring some aspect of the Mosaic law could have pacified the Jews, who were believers, apparently, in Jerusalem, zealous for the law, but still believed. That does raise a question, but the question is, how can they do that? We're looking now 2,000 years back with a lot of development of how this all works together. In the first century, you know, it took a while for all this to come together, right? And my book of Hebrews was meant to help explain all of that. I don't know when exactly it was written, but I just want to make the point that when you have a theological transition like this, it takes a while to get everybody up to speed and educated by the apostles. So now you got Paul showing up there. I don't exactly know the date of this, but you know, it could be maybe
it's right before 50s, his
late 50s.
It's right before the imprisonment in Rome.
Yeah, well, his imprisonment in Rome was roughly 62, but it took a while to get there because, remember, Felix left
right.
him in prison
a
for 2 years,
year, yeah.
You know, and there was all these steps. So let's just say late 50s. So you could just see how all of this more developed theology has not been completely disseminated yet. And I think what the Jewish leaders, the Christian leaders in Jerusalem are saying, look, you know, you got kind of a bad rap with some of these guys because of what's happened and everything. So why don't we just do these things to pacify them? Okay, now it didn't work. You know, the minute they saw Paul, they freaked out. And they thought he brought Gentiles in the temple and he disgraced the place. And then they arrested him and beat him and all this other stuff. But it did seem that they were practicing this form of the Mosaic law that was completely innocuous. And it was meant to pacify them for the time being. But I think stepping back, we can see all the teaching on this was in flux. And not that Paul didn't understand. He did understand. In fact, later in 1 Corinthians, he says, and this almost certainly was written before the events we're reading about in the book of Acts. In 1 Corinthians, he says, talking about preaching the gospel and being all things to all men, he says, verse 20, to the Jews, I became as a Jew. There it is. So that I might win Jews to those who are under the law. As under the law, though not being myself under the law, so that I might win those who are under the law. And so I think I see something like that going on here.
Mm-hmm. It's clear he's not thinking he's bound by the law. What he's doing, is, and it says here right in Acts 21, let's see what verse it is. I think it's verse 24. What the council wanted him to do was show that, quote, you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law. So if you're in that culture, walking orderly means following all of these rules. And Paul never tells people they're not allowed to do that. He never tells Jews to stop doing that. All he tells them is that this is not where your righteousness comes from, which is why it's fine for him to engage in these things. As he said, I've become all things to all people, because he's not viewing it as something that's giving him righteousness.
By the way, this brings up another point, too, and it has to do with stepping back a little bit and talking about the process of assessing these kinds of things. There's a difference between description and prescription. A description is when you describe, you tell what takes place. Then you have another step to figure out, why did those things take place? Did they take place because they were supposed to be that way or not? Prescription is a statement that tells what's supposed to be the case. So what here we have is a description. Here's what Paul did. The question is, why did he do that? Did he do that because he is under the law? Well, the answer to that is no, that option won't work as an assessment, because we have a prescriptive statement clear by Paul in another section that actually predates this event in time, and I just read it from 1 Corinthians 9, that he is not under the law. So there we have doctrine taught directly, and the taught doctrine has to take precedence over the description of events and any assessment that we'd make of those events that disagrees with the clear statement of Paul. This is a mistake people make a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, clearly a lot of the things that are brought up, well, if what you say is true, then why did they do this? Well, that's a good question. Let's talk about it. But we can't presume why they did it in a descriptive passage in a way that disagrees with what they state directly is doctrinally true about circumstances mm-hmm. like that.
And not only in the 1 Corinthians passage, but in Galatians and Romans and Hebrews, like there's so many mm-hmm. other passages that give explicit information about our relationship to the law.
Right, exactly.
Well, thank you, Greg.
You're welcome, Amy.
That was very interesting. You did not disappoint.
Well, every once in a while, a blind dog will find a bone, right?
And thank you, everyone, for your interesting questions. Please keep sending those to us on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.